God has spoken. That is perhaps the most foundational and, or one of the most important foundational and important truths there is. God not only created the angels, he not only created this cosmos, this planet, the trees and plants, birds, fish, reptiles, mammals, and finally, and most importantly of all, in his sight and in ours, human beings made in his very likeness. But having created them, his intention was that they would not only be created by him, but they would know about him. And of course, there in the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve were privileged to walk with the pre-incarnate Christ, and then the fall. So what was left after the fall? Was it just then down to each human being to try and reason, is there a God? And if there is, what is he like? Or did God leave something behind? Did God give us something whereby, despite the fact that we cannot see him, we might know him? Do you love books? When I packed up as pastor here, I had about an extra 1,500 books or whatever to get into our house. Our house was already bulging with books. We both love books. My mum always took credit for it as far as I was concerned, and I think mum's usually right. She said she instilled in me from a very young age the love of books. She certainly did read to us an awful lot when we were young. But do you love books? A number of times I've thought of classifying and cataloguing all my books. I've never got around to it, mainly because I can't decide how on earth I would actually divide them up. But I did learn very early on that there is a very simple division between most books. And that is, have I got this book? Do I love this book because of the pictures that are in it or because of the text that's in it? I've had some lovely picture books. Well, I think a lot of people call them coffee table books. There's one when I was young I used to borrow from the library probably a couple of times a year at least. On ice, rock or snow. No, on ice and rock and snow, I think is what it was called. By Gaston Rebuffet, who was my hero in my younger days. He was an alpine guide. And these amazing photos in the Alps, and photos of him climbing, doing incredible things. And I can't remember a word of that book. In fact, there weren't many words in there. But the photos, they're still there in my mind. That's one type of book. And then there's other books that may not have any photos in at all, but you love them because the text that's there, whether it be poetry, I love poetry books, or whether it's theology, or whether it's educational books, or novels, whatever it is, you just love reading them for the words and the language that's there. Well, God has basically spoken in those two distinct ways. He's spoken through a picture book, and he's spoken through a written textbook. And next time, God willing, as we come to the latter verses of Psalm 19, we focus on the textbook, and it's the greatest book there is in the world, the greatest book that's ever been written, the Bible. God's textbook to us. But first, the psalmist looks at the picture book God's given us, creation. And theologians give them two labels. They call the picture book, the book of creation, general revelation. And then the book that God has written us that's a textbook, special revelation. And we'll come on to that next time. My plan to split this psalm into two was mainly driven by the fact that I think we need to spend some time on this first one, creation, rather than just briefly go through it. For this reason, that so many in our generation have fallen in love with this creation to the extent that they're devoting their lives to it, but they've totally missed what it's all about. And if we're to talk to them about our God, and we're to talk to them about their need of Christ, we need to address that issue, why they're wrong, how they're wrong, and how they should be viewing it. And with that, the fact that most people you go to talk to about Christ, if your experience is anything like mine, immediately start using their wrong interpretation of creation to argue against the Bible and the God of the Bible. Which is ironic, because what the psalmist clearly lays out here in this psalm is that the two books are in perfect harmony. They're the two revelations that God has given that are showing the same thing, that he is the creator God and all that he has done for human beings on this planet. So for this evening, God's general revelation, verses 1 to 6, the glory of God. Let's start with the means. It's there in verses 1, 2, and verse 4. How has God made this general revelation available to us? Well, it's there, verse 1, the heavens. A bit further on in verse 1, the sky above. Verse 2, day to day, all that we see day by day of the natural world. It says night to night, the moon, the stars, the planets. Verse 4, the sun. I hope you enjoy the natural world that God's given us. I hope you enjoy just looking at it and spending time in it and listening to the amazing sounds of it. And we know so much more about it than David ever could. Let me just blow your mind for a couple of minutes. Our galaxy, what we call the Milky Way, is estimated to contain somewhere between 100 and 400, wait for it, billion stars. Now, I can't get my head around that. But then they tell us that within the visible universe, there is 100 billion galaxies. So if you take the average number of stars that there is therefore in a galaxy and multiply that by 100 billion, you get, wait for it, 10 sextillion. Now, if you're anything like me, you haven't got a clue what that is, so I'll tell you, it's 10 times 1,000 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 stars. And that's not in the universe, that's in the part that we can see from planet Earth. Light from the nearest star takes 4.3 years to reach us, travelling at the speed of light. That means when you go out tonight and you look up at the sky, the closest star that you can see to us, what you're seeing is what it looked like before Putin ever invaded Ukraine. It's taken that long for that image to travel to planet Earth. If we could travel at 150,000 miles an hour, and actually one of the rockets unmanned that they've sent into space and it's sort of circled and catapulted out, reached not short, far short of that. So if we could travel at 150,000 miles an hour, how long would it take us to get to that nearest star? In years? You say, 72? 72,000 years. The image behind us on the screen there is the Boomerang Nebula. It's the coldest place that's been found so far in the universe. That's about 5,000 light years from us, so that would take you about 100,000 years to get there. But that is at a temperature of minus 272 degrees centigrade. And this one small planet that God has chosen out, going around this one small star, in all of the immensity of the cosmos, God has filled with amazing things, hasn't he? Insects. You might not like them, but they are amazing. So far, they have identified some 900,000 species of insect. They estimate there's somewhere between 2 and 30 million species of insects on this planet. Something like 390,000 types of plants. And then you've got the reptiles, the amphibians, the mammals, the birds. And that's without going to microscopic life. And the sheer beauty of it. And why did God give us colour vision? I mean, we don't need it. But he gave it to us so that we can appreciate even more the wonder of all the colours that he's put into this creation. And you think about your own body. How many miles of blood vessels do you think there are in your body? 60,000 miles of blood vessels in the human body. 3 billion base pairs of DNA make up your being. And we could go on and on and on. And God has given us this amazing, beautiful, awesome planet in which we live, and he's filled it with this amazing life. That's the means, but he's given it to us with a goal. Here's the goal, verse 1. The heavens declare what? The glory of God. And the sky above proclaims what? His handiwork. We need to be so clear here, don't we? There are so many people in this world today, millions of people, who are enjoying this creation. They might give their lives to studying the stars. They might give it to studying animals. They might travel around the world to all these amazing places to look at all these amazing sights. And they're just obsessed with all the glory of it. But it's the wrong glory. All they're seeing is the glory of what God has made, not the glory of the God who's made it. It does not say, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of the heavens. It says the heavens declare the glory of God. When we look at the heavens, we're not supposed to say, wow, those heavens are glorious. They are. But what we're supposed to see is those heavens are glorious. How much glorious must the one be who made them? And when you miss that, you miss everything. In fact, you become the very people that Paul writes about in Romans 1. This is what he says, Romans 1:18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness, listen to this, suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Listen to this. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Do you get what Paul's saying? When God created all of this, it declares his glory, and every human being who has looked at it or listened to it knows that there is a God behind it, but has chosen to suppress that truth and chosen instead to say, I don't want that God. I would rather worship what he's made instead. And so down through the history of this world, and I give you a list, these are all factual, some of them blow my mind, but down through history, people of other religions and people of none have worshipped, listen, cows, monkeys, ibis, eagles, hawks, leeks and onions. Why anybody would worship leeks and onions, I have no idea, but they did. The sun, the moon, mountains. And even those who worship the one true living God famously, of course, made a golden calf to worship. The very things that God has given to point to him, man has said, no, I'd rather worship that than the God who made it. The means, the goal. See next the clarity of this revelation. Before we move on from verse 1, do you remember those books of 3D pictures? You sort of stared at them for ages. It wasn't obvious what was in this picture at all. In fact, it just looked a mess. And then you stare at it, and some people never do seem to be able to get it, but if you get it, suddenly you see, amazingly, this 3D picture there. If you have never seen them, I've got a couple of books with me, so you can see them in refreshments afterwards. And they're amazing, but you've got to sort of unlock it. You've got to get into it. You've got to sort of focus and not focus and all the rest of it to be able to see. Is that what God did in creation? Do you need some special key to unlock it? Do you need some special insight to say, oh yes, I can see God in this? Absolutely not. Go back to verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. They shout it out. The sky proclaims his handiwork. You don't proclaim something by whispering it. You bellow it out. What does it say, verse 2? Day to day pours out speech. This revelation gushes and pours out. It's a floodwater of revelation. This is everything your eyes see. This is 24/7. It fills your eyes, your ears, your sense of smell, your sense of taste. You can't escape it. This is as bright as the sun at midday. It's as deafening as the crashing of waves on the seashore or the rolls of thunder overhead. My friend, you will never be able to argue. I really wanted to see God's hand behind the creation, and I couldn't see it. All I could ever see was the creation. I could not see that a God had made it. It's what the whole of creation is shouting forth 24/7. God made this. So we've got the means, we've got the goal, we've got the clarity. Then see the universality, verses 3 to 6. There is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them he has set a tent for the sun, which comes out like a bridegroom leaving his chamber, and like a strong man runs its course with joy. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, from one end to the other, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. I don't know about you, but I find verse 3 very interesting. In verse 2, the psalmist has just said, day after day, pours out speech. Then in verse 3, he says, there is no speech, nor are there words whose voice is not heard. Then you get into verse 4, and he says, their voice goes out and their words to the end of the world. So what's the psalmist saying here? Is there speech from creation or isn't there? Well, I suggest it's as simple as this. What he's saying is this. It's a picture book. It's pictorial. It's a universal language because there is no language involved in it. Just think for a moment. If God had actually made it that it's what we've got to read and, let's say, done it all in Hebrew, I'd be stuck because I can't read Hebrew. Or if he'd done it all in English, then half the world would be stuck because I don't need English. If he'd done it in, what was the language they came up with that they were going to use? I've forgotten what it was called now. But whatever it was, this universal language. I've got it written down here somewhere, but I won't waste time looking for it. Esperanto. Very good. Thank you. Nobody would understand it because who's learned Esperanto? But he hasn't done it with words. He's done it with pictures. And that's a universal language. I love to listen to a blackbird sing. In the summer, I can sit out there in the garden in the late afternoon and hear a blackbird sing, and it brings me to tears. I haven't got a clue what it's singing. Have you? I've not got a clue what words it's saying, but it speaks volumes. If I look at the stars, I don't hear any language. I don't hear any words. But what it's saying is deafening. God created all this. Not only is this revelation crystal clear, but it's everywhere present. Verse 4, their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the ends of the world. Verse 6, its rising is from the end of the heavens, and its circuit to the end of them, and there is nothing hidden from its heat. How many times have you heard someone say it would be unfair of God to punish people for their sin when they've never heard the gospel? They live in some remote land and the gospel's not yet got to their land. It would be unfair of God to punish them for their sin. Well, first of all, of course, it's absolutely fair and just of God to punish anyone for their sin, whether they've heard the gospel or not. If they've sinned, they deserve to be punished for it. But how much more so when he's actually given them this amazing revelation? Though they didn't need to know any language to read, it's all picture book. All they've got to do is look at it and know that there is a God who has made it. So this is God's general revelation. So what conclusions must we draw? Let me give you just two simple ones. First of all, in regard to God. What conclusion have we got to draw? God is. There is a God. This cosmos, this world, you and I are not some sort of freak accident. There was no Big Bang. There is no macro evolution. There never has been. God spoke and this was created. Fiat creation from nothing. But it then tells us some things about this God. According to Romans 1:20, it tells us about his eternal power and his divine nature. Many of you know that I love the book of Job. It's my favorite Old Testament book. And it's my favorite Old Testament book for four chapters, chapters 38 to 41. And they're the chapters where God speaks. And every time I read it, I'm amazed because there's poor old Job. You know, he's really gone through the mangle. I'm trying to think back to the days of washing machines when you had a mangle on the top. You know the thing, yeah? His life has been terrible. And he gets to this point and finally God opens his mouth and speaks to him. And you're like, at last. And what does God do? He blasts Job. Four chapters of rhetorical questions, some 46 in the English translation, rhetorical questions. And what are they all to do with? His work of creation and his work of providence and caring for what he has created. And he absolutely blasts Job with this. Where were you? What do you know about what I did? And it blows Job's mind. And that's what should happen to us every time we look at this creation. It should absolutely blow our minds that there is a God behind it who simply spoke and created all that is, including you and I. That's what we should conclude about God. What should we conclude about me? Well, since there is a God, and since he made everything, that includes he must have made me. And if God made me, then I owe everything to him. I owe him my gratitude, I owe him my thanksgiving. Whether I'm saved or not, whether I've heard the gospel or not, I owe him my worship because he made me. He sustains me. He gives me the breath to breathe. He gives me the food to eat. He gives me the heat of the sun to live by. I owe him everything. So what responses should we make? Here very briefly are four. First one's this, we should appreciate the natural world. Please don't think that what I'm trying to say here in these opening verses of Psalm 19 is that we shouldn't enjoy the creation, we should only enjoy the creator behind it. No, we should enjoy the creation. God has given it to us. This is what we read in 1 Timothy 6:17. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, not to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. God has given us this that we might enjoy it. That's why he's given us colour vision. That's why he's given us a sense of smell. That's why he's put smells in all of these flowers and everything else, that we can enjoy them. I love what it says of Solomon. He was given more wisdom from God than any man who's ever lived. And this is what we read of him. 1 Kings 4:31, for he was wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. I like that round number, 1,005. We know that part, but it's this next bit. Listen to this. He spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and of birds and of reptiles and of fish. And the people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon and from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. He loved the natural world and studying it and enjoying it with the wisdom that God had given him. My friends, we are to enjoy God's creation. But here's my second point. We should enjoy and appreciate even more the one who created it. And the more we see that amazes us in this creation, the more it should make us be amazed at the God who made it. Isn't that right? It's a very simple test. Next time you see something in nature, next time you look at something, you say, that is so lovely. Just think, have I stopped there? Or am I then going on to think about how amazing is the God who made it? And I have to pull myself up on that all the time because I love the creative world. I just got myself a book on understanding bird songs and I'm trying to work my way through that. It's very technical. And the bees, you know, we keep bees. And I'm just so amazed at these animals that God's created. But to remember that that is there to speak to me about the awesome God who made it. We should enjoy the natural world. We should be amazed even more at the God who made it. This is how William Wordsworth put it. How beautiful this dome of sky, and the vast hills in fluctuation fixed at thy command, how awful shall the soul, human and rational, report of thee even less than these? Be mute who will, who can, yet I will praise thee with impassioned voice. My lips that may forget thee in the crowd cannot forget thee here, where thou hast built for thy own glory in the wilderness. My friends, when you look at this, remember and praise the God who made it. Thirdly, if you're a Christian, you should not be scared of standing up for your Creator God in this world. Matthew told me of an experiment he'd done with Grok. Grok's an AI bot, you call him? Whatever. Grok is one of the AI neural networks, whatever you want to call them, that exist in the world today. And it's claim to fame is the fact that they've minimized the amount of bounds that they've set for it. So it basically tells you what it thinks without them being told you can't say that and you can't say that. It just says what it thinks. And Matthew put this question to it, and I was blown away by the answer. So I thought, I've got to do this. So I'll put it in. Here's the question. Grok, working only from your reasoning and without being biased in any way by what are the most popular theories, how do you reason this world came into existence? So I haven't led it. I haven't suggested to it what answer I want or anything like that. I've just said, you tell me from your reasoning as a computer, basically, without taking into account anything that anybody else is saying or whatever else, how would you argue this world came into existence? 2 seconds, and I had 2 pages of A4 as an answer. This is how it started. To answer this purely from first principles reasoning, without leaning on any religious text, cultural narrative, or currently fashionable scientific theory, I'll strip the question down to its logical core and examine what can and cannot be concluded with intellectual honesty. And he then goes through these 2 pages, and this is his conclusion. Sorry, its conclusion. Therefore, on purely rational grounds, untainted by popularity or cultural bias, the existence of a necessary intelligent foundation, what philosophers historically label, quote, God, though without any specific religious doctrine attached, is the least arbitrary, most explanatorially powerful conclusion available. This is not a proof in the sense of deductive certainty. Philosophers from Aristotle and Leibniz to modern thinkers like Swinburne and Fieser have reached similar conclusions using different premises, but it is where the cold light of reason, unaided by revelation or faction, most naturally leads when one refuses to stop asking why at an arbitrary point. So my unbiased first principles answer is the world most reasonably came into existence because a necessary, timeless, eternal, immaterial, spiritual, intelligent reality, the ultimate ground of all possibility, exists by its very nature and freely chose to create a finite, ordered cosmos capable of bearing life and mind. Everything else, Big Bang, quantum vacuum, multiverse, etc., at best describes mechanism, not ultimate origin. Awesome! I went to bed really happy after that. It was quite late in the day. I woke up in the morning and I thought, I want to ask it another question now. So I grabbed my laptop, which is always next to me in bed, and said, thank you. Given your previous answer, what would you reason is the reason why so many people claim to be atheists? This was his answer. Given the reasoning I've just laid out, that a necessary, intelligent, timeless foundation is the most rationally satisfying ultimate explanation, the obvious follow-up is indeed, then why do so many intelligent, honest people firmly reject that conclusion and call themselves atheists? Here are the causes that seem to me, again working only from observable facts and psychological stroke logical dynamics, to explain the phenomenon best. And it gives eight reasons. Let me just read reason six. The desire for moral and existential autonomy. If there is no God, then I am the highest authority in my moral universe. I get to define meaning, sexuality, life goals, etc., without answering to anyone else. For many people, especially in late modernity, that freedom is experienced as liberating and worth protecting at all costs, even if it requires rejecting evidence or arguments they might otherwise find convincing. How true is that? And this is his bottom line. So the same species that can build particle colliders and write symphonies also contains individuals who reject the most profound intellectual solution available, that there's a God who made it all, because it feels emotionally unsatisfying or socially costly. That simply describes the human condition. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting we go to AI to interpret God's word for 1 second. I'm saying that what the psalmist is saying here in Psalm 19 and scripture is saying in Romans 1 and in many other places is this. You don't need a Bible to discern that God created everything. You just look at it and it screams it out. And here you've got a computer that is saying, if I'm totally unbiased, the most rational, logical, intellectual explanation of how this world has come into being is that there is an eternal being, traditionally called God, who chose of his own free will to create all of this and give it what it has got. And if people say they are atheists and there is no God, they're deceiving themselves. And ask the third question. I won't go into that now, but if you want to sit at coffee, I'll tell you. Because I then said, so what do you make of it in the psalm where it says, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God? My friends, we shouldn't be scared to stand up for our Creator God in this world. We have got the truth. We have got what is self-evident. If the world rejects it, they are deliberately choosing to ignore the evidence that's before their eyes. They're deliberately choosing, I do not want to submit myself to a God. I will not bow the knee. I love what he's created. Wonderful billboard. I'm amazed by it. I'm in love with it. I will worship it, but I will not worship the one who made it. Which leads to me my fourth, final point. If you're not a Christian, you should be very, very scared. Because the day is coming when you'll not be looking at a picture that God has painted. You'll be looking face to face at God himself. And you won't then be able to say, but I don't believe there's a God. My friend, if you're not a Christian, what this creation should do, it can't save you. You can stare at it every moment of the rest of your life and it will not bring you one step closer to being saved. But what it should do is convince you that there is a God and that you desperately need that God to show you how you can be saved. And that's what he does in special revelation, which God willing we'll look at next time. In his second book, the Book of Words, the Bible. We're going to sing...